Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We're going to be looking at data-backed HR trends for 2024. Before I get into who I am and how this session is going to work, I want to introduce you to my great guest, which is Jules Strong, VP of Marketing and Insights at Lattice. Jules, would you mind telling us a bit about who you are, what Lattice do, before we get into some more talking points for today?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, firstly, thank you so much for inviting me to be part of the webinar today. It's amazing to be here, and hi, everybody. Yes, I am head of marketing, VP of marketing, EMEA at Lattice, and part of that is heading up our research and insights for the whole EMEA region. I've been at Lattice for just over 2 years, and I'm based out of our international hub in London. And from that hub, we look after all of our customers across Europe, Middle East, and Africa. For those of you who don't know Lattice is a comprehensive people success and management platform that really helps customers drive great business results, lots of business impact, and high performance cultures. And we work with over 5,000 businesses around the world, including brands like Monzo, Tide, Intercom, HelloFresh, and many more, as you can see on the slide here.
Perfect. Thanks, Jules. And if you don't know about HowNow, who I am, my name is Gary Stringer. I'm the content marketing manager at HowNow. We are a learning platform that help companies make meaningful learning a part of everyday work. I'll explain a little bit more about that later, but a big part of that is helping companies identify their skills gaps, close them through relevant learning, and help their people build the skills they need to perform but grow in their careers. We mentioned data-backed at the start, and we also recently published the 2024 L&D Trends Report, which brings together data from more than 20 reports from the likes of Gallup, Lattice, CIPD, Betterworks, AppSpace, to give you realistic and unbiased trends for the year ahead. You'll see a link for the guide in the chat shortly, but essentially it gives you a good summary of each of these seven trends, the context of how we got here, and then two or three practical recommendations for how you can get ahead of that trend for the year ahead. Jules, I wanted to hand back to you because, like I said, a lot of the conversation today will be informed by the great data that you've done at Lattice recently. So I'd love to know just a bit of a summary about that survey itself, but also the top level findings as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Gary. We love taking surveys at Lattice. And this latest survey we executed with YouGov, and we polled 1,000 UK employees to find out how the balance of wellness and performance was showing up inside of their business. And specifically, we wanted to find out what businesses were doing to set up employees for success in sort of the current climate. And if we just go to the next slide, Gary, this is a quick snapshot of what UK employees are being offered by way of benefits or not by their employers. So you can see there's a big focus there on flexibility. We've got some mental health and wellness support. We touched on performance-based bonuses a moment ago, to a smaller degree, cost of living support. But actually, 17% of people were not receiving any of these benefits. So it was a very, very telling survey. We got lots of great insights out of that. I think we're going to step through a few of them and share those out today, aren't we, Gary?
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting and eye-opening that proportion of people didn't have any access to those benefits. That is really surprising, I would imagine, to a lot of people, especially me the first time I read it as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like Jules said, we're going to tackle some of these today. I wanted to give you a quick run through of the key trends we're going to talk about today. But the first is this idea of career conversations and how we can do those more effectively. The second is why we might need to shift from hiring to upskilling in 2024 and beyond. We're also going to tackle better flexible working and what this looks like in practice, and what AI should look like from the HR perspective and Jules's thoughts on that. So we're going to get into that in a second, but I'm going to stop sharing my screen. Unfortunately, I'm not at that point now where I still have to tell you I'm not sharing my screen because I'm not that quick. So perfect. Jules, if people download the guide that I mentioned at the start, they'll see some very interesting data around progression and development. So 75% of employees said they would prefer to advance at their current company, but only 48% can currently see a career path. So I found it really interesting that when you asked those 1,000 people what of the 14 factors they had available to, things like career conversations, career paths, and professional development budgets came bottom of the list. So I'd just like to get your take on maybe why career conversations have slipped onto the back burner a little bit, or any insights you had on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was certainly how the data showed up. And I think we were quite surprised by that to start off with as well. Certainly when we've done other surveys like this in the past, or we've done our annual State of People Strategy research study, career development has always sort of pegged in the sort of top half, sort of, you know, down to, you know, certainly the middle of the pack. And it didn't show up this way. And as you say, you know, regular career development conversations were the norm for only 15% of employees, which was staggering. 13% only had that clear career growth path, and just 11% had access to a budget allowance for their professional development. So all of that paints a picture that looks like career growth and development might well have been deprioritized. I think actually what's really happening is it's not that it's no longer important in the business, but actually with everything that's been going on in the world over the last few months, it's more that HR teams have had to index on areas that needed additional focus to counteract some of the working environment patterns we're seeing, what's happening in the macroeconomic world, and just really give extra focus to that. And I think, you know, HR teams at the moment are trying to grapple with this development of a high performance culture in the workplace, but they've also got to support teams through factors like the cost of living crisis, or the fact that they need more flexibility to be able to achieve a balance between work and home. So I think I think that's really what's showing up here. Not that the businesses don't care about it anymore, but we're in such a place in the world right now that's impacting performance in the business, is impacting employee wellness, and HR teams are mobilizing to get around that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's such a volatile world, and you know, you have to prioritize certain things. And I think you're right. It's not necessarily there's any intention to not prioritize these things at the moment, but we have to be reactive to the things around us and where our employees most need support. And actually, I think your data really supports that, because things towards the top of the list, like we saw on the slide before, were flexible work policies that would support people through things like COVID, and then also into cost of living and better work-life balance, mental health support, flexible time off, so people could really prioritize things outside of work as well. So yeah, I think really your data does talk us give us that insight as well, but I'd love to hear your insights on why those other things were at the top of the list.
Yeah, I think that's just a great way of framing it. So yes, to your point, when we were looking at the most prominent benefits in the business, the highest rated benefit was flexible working policies. And almost half of the people that we surveyed were seeing that being offered to them in their workplace, which is great. Over 40% had access to mental health and wellness support, and almost 40% had flexible time off. And I think that's the first time we've seen this collection of benefits feature so strongly. And I think that's kind of indicative. I think, you know, at a time where there's a lot of turbulence, there's, you know, a lot of focus in the business on driving maximum performance, there's a lot going on outside of work, HR teams are really knuckling down, focusing on engagement. They're really focusing on how engaged their employees are, and, you know, creating that sense of well-being. I think there's another piece of this, is that for me, businesses are still really managing the impact of the pandemic in the workplace. And that, coupled with the turbulence of the sort of macroeconomic world, has given both businesses and employees uncertainty. But I think as we go into 2024, it's really encouraging to see those flexible policies bubbling up on the benefits roster. But the challenge for businesses now, I think, is going to be really getting their arms around and recognizing that relationship between well-being and performance, which is already happening. But also, it's like a trifecta, the relationship between well-being, growth, and performance, because all of those come together to actually create some kind of resilience within the business. And I think, you know, growth is probably one of the strongest factors when we think about employee motivation. So if we have motivated and engaged employees, they will naturally perform well. And ultimately, that's going to enable both the employee and the business to get their best outcomes. In fact, we've got another research study that's coming out a little bit, I think in about 2 weeks now, where we index specifically on how HR leaders were thinking about talent development from their perspective and how it featured on the agenda in 2024. And half of them said that they saw that as being a really key part of driving a high performance culture. So I think, you know, there's definitely going to be some evolution here. I think, yeah, really locking down on that relationship between those three factors is going to become super important.
Yeah, that's great to hear, because I think you're right. There's this synergy between the three things. People need that well-being support. People need support through current crisis, but they also need growth and purpose. And actually, this might be a nice opportunity. We're going to get onto skills and why they matter at the moment. But this could be a chance to be proactive, because we know that people fear their skills becoming outdated. We know that people need to be reskilled. So actually, if this hybrid between them comes together and we are having people prioritizing skill development as well as part of that overall package, then the three boxes will be ticked. We'll still give them that support through things like well-being, but we're getting a little bit ahead of the idea of people need to be reskilled. So I'm really in agreement with what you said, and excited to see the new research on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also wanted to give people some maybe tangible tips or actions they could take away and apply, Jules. And for me, two things came to mind here. One would be the idea of having conversations around growth and development. And I think there's a temptation when you hear that these have fallen onto the back burner to want to just do more of them. So for example, why that might not work is if people said to us that they didn't think their feedback was being heard, rolling out just more surveys wouldn't help. We would need to be able to communicate to them where we were using that feedback and how we were using it to improve. And the same thing is happening here. If we just put more career conversations in the calendar without being structured, without having purpose to them, we'll do a similar thing where we won't actually drive much change. So for me, it felt like, from what I was seeing, the idea of shifting these career conversations as well to be built around business problems to be solved and the role people play in them. And then alongside that, the skills people need to either grow in their career or the skills they need to remain relevant. So I think when we bring these career conversations back into the fold, to do it really with intention was the first thing. And part of that puzzle is enabling managers as well. I mean, managers are the person, or the single person, I suppose, with the most influence over someone's performance and growth. There's a stat that I love, that 48% of people say they love working for the manager versus 39% for their company. And in the guide, I found this stat that there were six areas that managers really wanted most support and enablement in. And they were things like coaching and career paths and empathy. So I think the other part is working out where your managers need enablement to have those better career conversations and then targeting the relevant learning to them. But any thoughts on that, and anything from your perspective, Jules, on how we can actually start having those better career conversations in 2024?
Yeah, I love those stats too. They're eye-opening, aren't they? And I think both those points really resonate with me. As we go into 2024, I think all businesses have a real opportunity to rethink how career growth and development shows up in the business. And I think, you know, there was a point where growth and development conversations were those sort of planned, structured, once a year conversations that, you know, maybe nobody kind of really looked forward to, or, you know, it felt quite forced and unnatural. And I think as we go into 2024, there's a real opportunity to simply make growth part of our DNA and to make it a part of the day-to-day business. And the reason I think that's important, Gary, is going back to this sort of turbulent world that we're in right now, is if growth is embedded into the day-to-day business and the ongoing relationship between the manager and the employee, there's much less chance of it getting left by the wayside when times get busy, or where there's change happening in the business, or some form of unrest. So I think, yes, to your first point, don't talk more, but make more of every conversation and make growth a really integral part of that. So I think, you know, the employee manager one-to-one, that's a great place to get started. So if businesses aren't having regular one-to-ones between employees and managers, that's a great place to start and actually make sure that growth becomes part of that focus. I can give you a couple of examples of how we manage that at Lattice, if that's useful. Yeah. We actually use the Lattice tool because we get sight of employee growth areas right in the manager and employee one-to-one. So it doesn't matter how much is going on when you're thinking about topics that you want to cover with your manager or with your employees, very visually, growth is right there as a reminder. That's a great thing to check in on, which I love and I find very useful personally. I think also, you know, really making sure that you tailor your growth conversations, recognizing that growth shows up differently for everybody in the business, and you know, managers being equipped to actually tailor those conversations to the individual just really helps it become part of everyday employee engagement. So yes, to your point, management, you know, manager enablement is absolutely vital to this. I always say that, you know, the manager is the linchpin between what the business wants to achieve and how that shows up in terms of everyday engagement for the employee. And candidly, for some managers, if growth isn't part of that everyday conversation, getting started with that can be really hard, and it can feel forced and unnatural. And when things feel forced and unnatural, it's very, very hard to get that embedded into the DNA of the business. So having the right frameworks and tools and guidance materials, templates, is going to be an important part of making that feel natural for managers. And there's lots of content out there that we can leverage, but just making sure that managers have career discussion guides and they have templates and prompts and tools that help them do that alongside more traditional training is definitely going to set the organization up for success. And if I may add a third point to the two that you raised, and that's around empowering employees to be part of their own growth journey. The moment you start to make growth part of that everyday conversation, it makes it much easier to also get some autonomy and some empowerment into employees to be in charge of their own growth. And in this study, we found that only 15% of employees had access to mentorship. We saw before about, you know, how regular career conversations were happening or how often professional development budget was being made available. These are all really powerful tools that allow the employee to be on the front foot and be in the driving seat of their own growth. And HR teams can use things like individual development plans and competency frameworks, as well as more sort of structured processes that just really enable the employee to come to those discussions with their manager, with their own ideas and their own plan and their own requests. And that can just be a really powerful way of not making growth about the manager delivering that to the employee, but the two of them actually forming that plan together and having that conversation, planning and delivering that as part of a continuous motion. And I think, you know, as we go into 2024, it'd be great to see more businesses, embrace that way of thinking about growth.
Yeah. I really love that point about it becoming part of your DNA, because I think the problem is that the yearly performance review just becomes this one thing and nothing at once. You know, it's, we're going to sit down and check on what happened in the last year, plus build a plan for you for the future. And then maybe we'll check in a couple of times. And that feeds into some stats in the guide. I can't remember the top of my head, but there was a huge proportion of people that thought their performance review process was often or always a waste of time. And that's because so many of the things you said there, if they're not happening regularly, we're all out of the practice of doing it. So like you say, managers, it might feel forced for them. Employees don't really feel like they have ownership. And to the point that we mentioned before, the world is changing so fast that think about everything that's happened in a year. Your job could look vastly different between now and a year's time because changing priorities around you. So I think this idea of making it part of the DNA, making sure people are doing these conversations regularly, I think that is such a crucial point, because otherwise it is going to be this sort of like relic in the corner that happens just once a year and does very little for anyone. So yeah, I love that point. You mentioned a bit about autonomy there, and that's a nice segue into our next trend, which is flexible working policies and what they might look like in 2024. So we mentioned that flexibility was high on the list of what employees were currently being offered. And I think the other part of your research really shows why, because it was second on the list of five factors that employees need to do their best work. So yeah, I'd love to know a little bit more on current state of flexible working, a little bit on those extra data points.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, as you say, we aside from asking employees to tell us what benefits were showing up in their business, we asked them what they needed to do their best work. So kind of interesting cross-section across those two questions. And what they said to us was that flexible working came out second as being the second highest factor that enabled them to do their best work. So the good news is that that correlates with our earlier data point in that it's also a benefit that businesses are investing in. So nice to see that the employees are vocalizing that, they're recognizing that's really important and businesses are already responding. I would say as we go into 2024, I think flexible working is still very much evolving. But it is absolutely linked to trust and autonomy, autonomy for the employee and trust within the business. And that also played out in the research. So feeling trusted by managers was actually the most significant motivating factor for employees over flexible working, which is really telling. And then regular praise and recognition and being in a company culture that felt positive and inclusive, they were also factors that came out in the top five. So really, really telling picture that all shows that wellness comes from a combination of all of those factors. I think, as I say, flexible working is still very much evolving. I think for many businesses that maybe pre-pandemic had a largely in-office presence, that move to flexible working is still very much work in progress. And it can feel like quite a big shift away from the norm. So I think businesses of that type are still figuring it out. I will also say that, you know, as we have skills shortages and we're going to touch on hiring in a bit, so I don't want to dive too deep there. That means that, you know, the business is constantly evolving. So even if a business feels like they've got a really good read on what flexible working looks like for them right now, there is every chance that halfway through 2024, they're evolving that again. So I think agility is really the name of the game of how that's showing up at the moment. But reality is there's a vast ream of research that shows that's what employees want. They want that flexibility and they now kind of expect it. So just from an employer brand perspective, businesses are having to get their arms around that. I talked about trust and autonomy a moment ago. One of the other things that I think is closely linked to flexible working and we're seeing become very prevalent at the moment is businesses moving towards a more results-orientated culture. And that type of culture is gonna help businesses build resilience and retain their top talent and set themselves up for growth, I think, going through 2024 and beyond. And the reason the results-orientated culture is becoming so important for a lot of businesses is because it really pivots the focus away from evaluating performance on the number of hours that people work or how present and visual they are. And it pivots it based on their output. All of it is about the performances on output and not by input. And we're definitely seeing that being something that businesses are actively exploring as part of that flexible working policy, because it's so vital for enabling people to actually do their best work. If you're offering flexible working and employees can flex their style, maybe their location and their working hours, they're naturally going to feel more energized. They're going to feel less conflicted between work and home. And the business can reasonably expect a stronger output as a result. So I think as we head into 2024, flexible working will continue to change. There's going to be some leveling around businesses just figuring out what is the right model for them individually. But what is going to be important is creating those mechanisms that actually not only provide flexibility for employees, but they really dial down on that trust element and ensuring that there's visibility around how employees are working and what that output looks like is going to become increasingly important to ultimately just allow flexible working to be successful. And I think the visibility there is going to be a key aspect.
Yeah. And I think people might be surprised to see flexibility still being on this list of trends, because it's been going on since 2020 when it really came to the fore. But I think your point there is so true. It's still evolving. There's still a lot of things to be figured out. And 2024 is about that mix of refining your approach and still being agile to respond to it. And one interesting part of the flexibility puzzle that doesn't seem to have been solved is this pressure that people feel to be available and online all the time. So there's two great stats from Slack. One of them is 53% of desk workers feel pressure to respond to messages quickly, even if they're sent outside of work hours. 63% make an effort to keep their status active and online, even if they're not working at the moment. So I think process and culture have to enable the people to work flexibly alongside that trust and autonomy. One of the biggest reasons this resonated with me is actually this is one of the biggest pain points we solve for our customers, because a lot of the time, the reason people are asking questions on Slack typically outside of work hours when they're working at different times, is they don't know where to find the answer. And that's typically because information is either scattered in a lot of places, it's not in a central place where it can be found, or the repeat questions that are being asked to your best people and your subject matter experts, people aren't capturing those answers. So this is how we get into this culture of lots of repeat questions on Slack, people having to ask before they can search. And that only adds to the pressure of people feeling like they need to be able to respond outside of the work hours. So for me, I think that's such a simple way to remove a barrier or make flexible working work for more people, because when we're working at different times, we're not feeling a pressure to respond urgently to messages. So I really feel like there are still parts of the puzzle to be solved. But from your end, Jules, any other things people can do process wise or any other thoughts on really nailing flexibility in 2024?
Yeah, I think the key thing really is to make sure there are clear guidelines and tools to support that way of working. I mentioned before about visibility. It's really, really important that managers and execs have visibility into individual and team performance. I think when managers feel like they're in the dark or they don't understand what people are working on or what they're achieving or what the outputs are, that's a really ripe breeding ground for mistrust. And it's also a ripe breeding ground for employees, to your point, feeling like they need to respond to messages quickly. They need to be always on, always available. And that's just such a big factor in burnout. So for me, that visibility and having clear guidelines and tools to support that way of working is really important. So I think HR teams can get on the front foot with that and put some of those tools and processes in place to really allow async information sharing. And, you know, make sure that that information flow can happen very, very naturally inside and outside of hours, depending on when the employee is working and when that output is taking place. So some of the ways that you can do that, there's obviously tools, communications tools that we can use that support that. Excuse me. But I think things like, you know, weekly updates between an employee and a manager on all the sort of core work output for that week, what the focuses are going to be for the following week, they can be a really great way of getting that visibility and also demonstrating and empowering the employee to demonstrate their accountability as well. And I'm going to come back to the employee manager connection time again. I think in a results orientated culture, that is so vital to keep that visibility and that open communication going. Another thing that I would point out, which I think is really, really important to make that work well, is a clear view of goals and OKRs so that everyone knows how performance is being evaluated and benchmarked. And this research study actually showed, I think we mentioned before, that, you know, just one in five UK employees say that they truly understand how their employer is assessing their performance and what their expectations are. And I found this so interesting because, you know, this isn't setting anyone up for success, and this isn't actually helping to have that flexible working and that results orientated culture, you know, really humming. You know, where you've got a disconnect between what good looks like, what your goals are, how your performance is being assessed, that's creating an environment again where not only mistrust can come in, but actually it's very, very hard for the employees to strike that level of achievement and to feel, you know, motivated that they're achieving their goals. So establishing clear metrics by which performance is assessed and making sure that those performance conversations are happening regularly, rather, to your point earlier, Gary, than that once a year conversation is really vital. And the last thing I just throw in there, I think, is, you know, just feedback and praise. I think that came out in our top five factors that allowed employees to do their best work. But that can, you know, HR teams can, you know, really think about how to drive programs that encourage and facilitate and showcase feedback and praise. So when employees are performing well, and they're living the company values and they're doing well in a flexible working environment, that's very visible across the organization. You know, there are many ways that HR tech and HR processes can help to create those praise and recognition programs.
Yeah, I think what's sticking out to me now, having spoken through this, is the two points are really linked to each other. If people are going to have trust, autonomy, and flexibility to do their best work, then that comes from having clear conversations around where you're going in your career, how you contribute to business performance. And like you said, having the clear metrics on that point. Cool. I'm conscious of time, so we'll move on to our third trend, yeah. Jules, as well, which is the shift from hiring to upskilling and a focus on internal mobility. So one thing I found when researching the trends guide that I mentioned at the start is Udemy's top seven surging skills for workplace and human resources were dominated by recruitment and hiring, which means content on Udemy about those two subjects saw the biggest increase in consumption. And we're interestingly in this period of talent shortage. So there's six open roles for every qualified person, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So although it's good to be hiring savvy and really flex those skills in a competitive landscape, we also can't put all our eggs in that just hiring to fill skills gap basket. So just curious about your thoughts on the current hiring landscape and why we might need to shift towards upskilling over the next year or two.
Yeah, I mean, the hiring landscape is so tough right now, isn't it? I mean, we definitely saw skills shortages become a thing as we went through that period of the Great Resignation, but I don't think it's ever fully settled back down again to pre-pandemic norms. I think that's the reality. I saw a fascinating stat in one of the recent CBI surveys, actually, and 30% of businesses said they couldn't grow over the last 12 months that we've just been through because they didn't have the right skills in the business and they could see the demand, but they couldn't go out and capitalize on that demand because they didn't have the right people in the right roles, which I think is really, really sad. So I do think there's a need to think about the role and the potential impact of upskilling as an alternative to just straight hiring in the organization. And to my mind, it brings a number of benefits. If you have a strategy and a path in your business to upskill your top talent, your highest performers, that's naturally going to drive more motivation, more satisfaction. And those people are going to feel more committed to their roles and to your company because you're investing in that area. And that's just such a natural tie into a high performance culture, which we spoke about before. I think the second thing that jumps out is that hiring is expensive and it's turbulent. It takes time, you know. And actually, if you've got people leaving the business in open roles, you're losing your organizational knowledge. As I say, it takes time and it's costly. So actually, the more you can reduce that attrition and give people a reason to stay inside of the business through upskilling, that's got to be a great outcome. And I think, you know, outside of just that mitigating costs and turbulence, thinking ahead to the future, the businesses that really think carefully about upskilling and invest in that and create the processes for that are really ultimately just future-proofing their business. I actually genuinely think that keeping your top talent in the business and giving them a career growth path, giving them skilling, is actually giving you a competitive advantage. And I think, you know, we're in a world where businesses need to make their jobs as attractive as possible, given the current hiring landscape. And certainly some of the facts like flexible working that we spoke about, having a culture based on output and results and performance and investment in employee growth are just absolutely part of that in, you know, building your employer brand and making your jobs as attractive as possible. And so, yeah, I'm excited to see how that develops over the coming months.
Yeah. No, me too. And I totally agree. I think I saw some interesting data in the last few weeks, and there was a stat that the C-suite thought that half of today's workforce skills won't be relevant in a few years. And a third of employees felt overwhelmed by the pace of skills change and potentially that their skills could be relevant in 1 to 2 years. So between leadership and employees, there's this agreement that we need to be focusing on skills. So it's such a no-brainer to make this a core part of your development strategy. You can future-proof the skill set you have as a company and as teams. You can give people real purpose to build skills that drive that performance. And I think that is just a perfect reason to shift to that. And then to your point about it being expensive, this is definitely a more sustainable approach, because every time you hire people, there's not only the cost of hiring, but the cost of that person getting to know the company culture, the product, the ways of working. By the same token, if our people aren't growing and we don't retain them, that lost knowledge is massive to us as well, because no one has time to relearn the things we already knew as companies. And especially as quick as the world is changing now, we need to build compound knowledge together. So we need to retain our best knowledge. And if we don't, I think people overlook the sheer cost of not only that person taking that with them, because so much of the knowledge is business specific, but also the fact they will have to relearn it. Or my least favorite thing is when someone gives in their notice and you've got probably about 20 working days to capture 4 or 5 years of great stuff they built up on the job in that time. So for me, yeah, it just massively seems like such a no-brainer to focus on it. And I guess, again, coming back to the idea of practical steps or tangible tactics for people, anything that comes to mind for you, Jules, on really nailing this approach to upskilling and internal mobility?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of thoughts here. We touched already a little bit around employees wanting flexibility at work. And I think, you know, we can apply that to the world of upskilling as well. So I think it's really about giving employees choice, letting them design their own career paths, making sure that we have not only the culture that embraces that, but the processes and tools that embrace that as well. And allowing employees to decide what growth looks like for them, what upskilling looks like for them, you know, what they want their career path to look like. And for those folks where it's more of that sort of traditional ladder and they just want to become really, really skilled in their craft and it's, you know, a direct line promotion, I think that's great. But for many employees, certainly in our younger generations, they don't know actually what that career path looks like. It's more of a web or, a rock climbing wall is how I like to imagine that. And so actually having a structure and having a culture that allows employees to design their own career paths, I think is really, really important. We talked about growth not being that once a year conversation. And I think that's the same for upskilling as well. We don't want that to feel like a separate task. We want it to be something that employees look forward to engaging in every day. It feels part of their everyday role. And so their empowerment is a big part of that too. I do think it's worth touching on the fact that how we learn is changing. How we gather new skills and experience has changed in the last few years. When we were all in an office, we had those kind of water cooler moments, or we were learning by osmosis by listening to our colleagues, grabbing people for a quick chat in a corridor. And in a remote or a hybrid world, it's not as easy as that anymore. So as businesses, I think we need to be proactive in recognizing that and equipping our managers and equipping our employees to be arranging upskilling opportunities in a different way. So I think a great upskilling program needs to have a clear set of competency frameworks. It needs to have the tools to develop those individual development plans. Just provide a basis for very frequent, meaningful and ongoing conversations. If it's helpful, I'll offer one of the models that we use at Lattice to sort of give that a little bit of color and flavor. We use the 3 E's model. So for anyone that isn't familiar with this, it's an approach we use to upskilling that means that whenever we're looking at a growth area, we're looking at education or more formalized training. We're looking at exposure or mentoring, buddying up. And we're looking at experience, how you can actually get some of that experience in your present role. It's a really simple framework, but I personally love that. I think it's very useful because it brings together all the different elements of skills building. And it gives a nice structure again for employees and managers to come together and work on that. So that's a couple of thoughts on upskilling, but flipping over to internal mobility and kind of how we support employees as well as skilling them to actually then go and get those experiences. I said before, I think the culture is really important here. So having a culture where right from leadership down to management and to individual contributors, internal mobility is very transparent, is very clear, it feels achievable and it's celebrated is a really powerful team for keeping your top talent in the business and showing them that, you know, they can have a path that can show up in very different ways if they want to upskill and stay within your company. Just to come back to this point, you know, growth is not linear. It's not restricted to one function. And it will look very different for every employee. So, you know, really, we need to have open structures that allow people who want to explore different areas of the business, as well as that, you know, more traditional ladder style architecture, to be able to grow sideways, vertically, diagonally, whatever that feels like. So top-down commitment, really, really important. Having a structure that enables that, and then, you know, equipping managers with tools like 3 E's model. So we're thinking in a very 360 way about what upskilling looks like is going to be important, I think, for that kind of model. And ultimately, you know, moving towards that and being transparent about the desire to move towards that with our employees is just the ultimate demonstration of a commitment to help them grow.
No, I totally agree. I wanted to move on to our final trend, Jules, which is around AI from the HR perspective. So obviously a lot of the trends conversation has been dominated by AI, not just in HR and L&D, but a lot of industries. But what I've seen across the board is this real need and desire to use AI intentionally and not just for the sake of it or as a novelty. So just wanted to get your thoughts on how AI can be used in HR, how you see it at the moment, and what it might look like in 2024.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, isn't it just the hot topic right now? I think every kind of like article I read, every event I go to, AI is right there. Two thoughts on this. I think first of all, you know, AI is in businesses right now. Employees are using AI. They're curious, they're excited, they're definitely finding application in their role. So I think, you know, HR teams and leadership teams really need to invest time in understanding that technology and its risks and its benefits and how their employees are currently engaging with it. So I think, you know, really invest in active listening, going out, asking the questions, gathering feedback, understanding how it's showing up in different parts of the business and what it's achieving is really important. And I think also understanding what problem it's solving, what it's trying to unlock, why employees want to do that is going to be important from an HR perspective. But the additional component is how HR can use those AI tools in their own day-to-day work. And I think there's a huge amount of potential there for improving productivity, for taking away all of those sort of manual and repetitive tasks that we know can often creep into an HR leader's day. And, you know, sort of take away some of that, you know, time wasted in starting blank sheet projects. You can see there's many potential applications there. But at Lattice, what we're hearing from HR leaders is that AI is never going to be a way to replace people and programs. It is all about optimization and efficiency. It's about helping HR teams spend less time buried in paperwork and really freeing them up. And I love this. This is really exciting. Freeing them up, spend more time making more of a strategic impact in the business, to be able to spend their time on the high value activities that they know are going to shift the dial. So I think there's lots of potential and promise there. What we do know is that over 3/4 of the HR teams that we spoke to recently said that they were discussing HR AI and they were looking at ways to use AI, but only about a third of them have actually started evaluating solutions. So I think we're really early days. I don't think there are any set paths or best practices as yet. I think we're definitely still in that exploratory phase. And I think how impactful and relevant AI is going to be is going to, again, be so individual. It's going to be a case-by-case business for HR teams. But I think as we get through the first half of 2024, Gary, we're definitely going to start to see some of those best practices emerge. I think we're definitely getting close to that.
Yeah. Yeah. I had Egla Vinayaskauta on the podcast recently, and everyone should follow Egla if they're not, for some great insights on AI and L&D and HR, but echoed so much of what you said. You know, there's no best practices yet, there's just common practices. So make sure you're not just getting wrapped up in how other people are using it, but really focusing on how it solves problems for you. And something that Egla shared with me is this insight. She spoke to a small group of business leaders, but where AI was being adopted across a business, it was being driven by a business need rather than L&D or HR taking it to the business and trying to get it implemented that way. So couldn't agree more with all of that. Jules, we want to give people a little bit of a recap and then go through a couple of examples of how this might be used in practice. So I'm just going to share my screen again so we can do that. And then while we're doing this, if you want to drop any questions in the Q&A, once we're done with this section, we are going to take your questions. So to recap where we're at, we need to have better career conversations that are linked to performance, progress in 2024 and beyond. To give employees the best chance of doing their best work, we need that flexible working that's built around trust and autonomy. Internal upskilling and internal mobility can help us solve this crisis of everybody need to be reskilled in the next few years. And like Jules said, AI should be used intentionally to solve problems in your business and then free up your time to do more of the things that matter. So really, intentionality is the message on the AI front. So we want to just spend a couple of minutes giving you two examples of how this might look in practice. Jules is going to take you through understanding and aligning with employee expectations, thinking about what we spoke about around career conversations and flexible working. And then I'll just spend a minute or so telling you about upskilling and reskilling and how we do that for the future of work. So Jules, over to you.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. So the first step really is to understand and align your teams and set them up to do their best work. So if we could just flip to the next slide, please, Gary. Perfect. Thank you. So Lattice is a people management platform that really enables you to do that and to deliver greater business outcomes through people strategy and people programs. So right now, businesses are indexing more and more around their talent as a strategic lever and how to maximize the return on investment from people programs. And Lattice actually supports HR leaders to become enablers in that process by focusing on three key elements. So the first is understanding and acting on your talent, identifying who your talent is and how to unlock them. The second is around driving alignment across the organization and clarity around company priorities. And the third is around building a high-performance culture where achievement is just simply part of how everybody works every day. And doing all of this while reducing the cost of your talent, your people programs. So Lattice actually provides capabilities that spans performance management, employee engagement, goal setting, employee development, and compensation management as well. And if we want to identify and activate key talent, we need to be able to gather and consolidate data around performance, engagement, and growth. And those unique insights are what allow us to take a very data-driven action and to understand whether we're looking to retain top talent or put a spotlight on low performance and address it. It's those unique insights bringing together data on those three areas that allows us to make very data-driven actions for our people programs. When we think about driving alignment and clarity, it's really important that employees have clear goals and performance expectations, and they understand how their output and their role actually relates to their big company objectives. And you can see here that Lattice actually allows you to set up individual goals and goals cascade in a very consolidated and visual way. So business leaders can see right at top level how the big company initiatives are faring from a goals achievement perspective, and the individual right down at the bottom level can see how they're performing individually and every measure in between. And then the final part is around building a high performance culture. So to do that, employees really need to know what great looks like. With Lattice, you can allow your employees and your managers to give and receive 360 degree feedback. It supports all of your conversations and your planning around growth and development, and you can link your compensation to performance. So you can recognize and reward your highest performers. And obviously that underlying data gives HR teams just an ongoing insight and control over what steps they need to take next to keep your culture developing. So the businesses that work with Lattice get a huge amount of compound value from centralizing all of their programs in this way. And importantly, it allows them to also keep people at the heart of their decision making. So I think we're going to have a mechanism a little bit later. If you want to find out more, we can follow up with you after the webinar.
Yes, absolutely. Cheers, Jules. So to come back to that point around upskilling and reskilling, one of the biggest challenges we see when it comes to making meaningful learning a part of everyday work is something we call the engagement gap. Now, you might have experienced this if you've created a bunch of content, really excited about it, you've hit send, and then nobody is engaged with it. And this is typically because the three things you can see on the screen aren't aligned. So the right learning to the right person at the right time. But when we do align those things, that's when we can drive engagement. And engagement is the primary requirement for learning to happen. If nobody's engaged, everything else you want to happen afterwards falls apart. So to give you an example, even if you get one of these things wrong, it can throw off the alignment between all three. So we might get the right learning to the right person, but if the timing's off, then it won't feel like relevant and role-related learning. So there's no point sending somebody a course on how to do a VLOOKUP in Excel 6 months before they're going to need to do it. Or we might get the right learning to people at the right time, but we don't have the ability to segment the people we're sending it to. So we send it out to everyone. And for most people, it doesn't feel like the right person. So there's three ways that we tackle this at How Now. The first thing is the right learning. The current challenge for a lot of companies is that resources are scattered in too many places. They might be in Google Drive. They're the internal files you've created and the stuff people learn from all the time, like webinars, YouTube videos, blogs, podcasts. One of the first things we'd help our customers do is centralize that all into one single place and build that learning ecosystem that brings everything to the end of one search. So everything is centralized. How do we get it to the right person? This is where at How Now we use AI to analyze millions of live job adverts and understand in-demand skills for a role, so you can map those skills quickly. Then we have a built-in 360 measurement tool that allows you to measure the skills you have internally and to what proficiency. And when we know those two things, we can deliver targeted learning. So for example, we might know that negotiation is a key skill for people in our sales team. And once we've measured proficiency, we can assign relevant learning to that topic to anyone who's a level 3 or 4 below in negotiation. And then last but not least, my favorite part, how do we get it at the right time? People are most motivated to learn in the flow of work in the moments that matter. By that, I mean when they encounter a problem that needs to be solved. And if learning can help them solve that problem, then it will influence performance. That is why we embed learning in the apps people use every single day, like Slack, Teams, HubSpot, and Salesforce, so that people don't need to leave the flow of work to learn and apply the things they need to learn. And that is very quickly how we bring the right learning to the right person at the right time to drive engagement in meaningful and relevant learning. So as Jules mentioned, you'll see a poll pop up very shortly. If you'd like to know more information about Lattice and How Now, just click yes to that poll and someone from our team will be in touch with you after this webinar. Perfect. Jules, we covered a lot of ground there.
We did.
Take a breath. So you'll see the poll pop up now. And we're going to take a few questions in a second. Jules, I actually had one thing that we didn't get onto, and this was this idea of the balance between why people should come into the office. So we know about trust and flexibility and autonomy, and we've seen a lot of interesting stories around companies maybe mandating people coming back to the office, the role that has on flexibility. And funny enough, I saw Molly, the co-founder of Flexer, put out some stats this morning that we can see that we've flattened out an average of 20 to 30% of the days worked from home last year. So it really does seem like we're coming back to the office, but is that being mandated? Is it actually there to drive performance? So just curious if you had any thoughts on that topic.
Yeah, again, I think it's a really individual thing. We're definitely seeing in some businesses and some sectors, there's a lot of desire from leadership to bring people back into the office. I think it's a really fine balancing act. We talked about the fact that upskilling and learning had needed to take a different form if people weren't in the office, because, you know, some of that learning by osmosis wasn't, you know, possible in a completely remote environment. I think the reality is there is definitely advantages that, you know, can be gleaned from time in the office. I think there's a lot of advantages that are gleaned from working from home as well. And that's where the flexibility is important. I hear a lot that people feel that in office time is a great culture driver, and actually having that face-to-face time can facilitate with culture. And I think that certainly for the younger cohorts and our employee base, just having that time interacting with others can go a long way. So I think it's individual. I think there's many ways that you can skin that. It's important to be regularly taking the pulse of how your employees feel about it. I will say, I do think that's vitally important, so that you land at a place that feels right for employees and it also feels right for executives. But I think there's ways that you can do that in terms of, you know, just regular in-office days where people come together specifically for collaboration opportunities, as opposed to, you know, just necessarily saying it has to be X number of days a week. But I think every industry is different. Every business is different. For me, the vital thing is, you know, just keeping an open mind, thinking about, you know, and asking what do your employees need, and then figuring out a way to hit that middle ground so that flexibility remains in place, but also you're taking advantage of some of the opportunities, collaborative opportunities you can have from in-office time together.
Yeah, no, I agree. So another good question from Andy in the chat. Andy had put something in there earlier around the idea of, if we create the outcome-focused culture, could that drive pressure from the top down? So I think this is a follow-on from that. But Andy said, if there's a trend towards results, how does HR balance this with trust and autonomy? For example, how do you gauge growing trust and autonomy versus the tangible outcomes/results and measures?
Yeah, I mean, I think we said when we were chatting, or I said it's like it is a symbiotic relationship. I think Every business wants to achieve results, whether you badge it as a results-orientated culture or not. You know, businesses need to achieve results to actually grow and survive in these turbulent times. I don't think I would advocate for over-indexing on results and losing any of your inherent people focus. You know, ultimately, if people are successful and they feel motivated, you know, you can't have business success without people success. That is the reality. But I think actually results-orientated focus in a culture that celebrates people success and people empowerment and setting people up for success, it's all part of a relationship, basically. Yeah. I would never advocate for a business that indexes only on results at the expense of everything else. But if you put the other pieces in place, and you give people flexibility and empowerment, and you've got strong people programs around them, it's enabling them to be successful. And then their success is judged on what they've achieved, not necessarily how many hours they've worked or whether they're always online and some of those other bits that we touched on that can start to index in another direction.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. And one thing actually I think that helps with this idea of if it feels like it's top-down pressure for outcomes is actually if people have some sort of input and ownership of what the outcomes are. So speaking from experience, that's something we do quite a lot. We'll have like the top-level objectives, but how we get there as a team and what our sub-team goals are, we set them collectively. So we all have this shared ownership and therefore it is an outcome result or result-based culture, but we've all had a say in what the results look like and the best ways to get there. And I think that for me would be the easiest win for people to make sure they're not feeling like there's too much pressure on people. And also that, you know, the earlier you get people invested in this, the more invested they'll feel. So I think that would be my
two-way communication, super important, as are, as you say, having those goals. And it can be incredibly motivating and empowering to understand how what you do every day is laddering up to those big company objectives. So I think transparency, visibility, two-way, getting everyone involved, super important.
Perfect. Excellent note to end on, Jules, because we've just hit time. So I just want to thank you massively for joining us today. I really enjoyed that conversation. Thanks to everyone who joined us for this as well. You'll be getting an email with all the links to watch this on demand, some key findings, some of those links to the reports, but also links to where you can connect with Jules and learn more about Lattice and where you can connect with me and learn more about How Now. So thanks again, and we'll hopefully see you again next time.